Welcome to the Thrillcast, Earthlets. Hope you had a good new year. Ours was tinged with sadness as we're very sorry to report the passing of artist Jim Baikie at the age of 77. Perhaps best known as co-creator of Skiz with Alan Moore for 2008, he also worked on Judge Dredd as well as the two Skiz sequels. His career in comics began with work for girls' titles, such as Valentine in the 1960s, and he went on to work on TV adaptations, such as Charlie's Angels, Star Trek, and Terrorhawks for Luckin. Jim worked on several DC titles, including the Electric Warrior Maxi series, Batman and The Spectre. He also produced New Statesman for the short-lived Crisis and illustrated Alan Moore's Tomorrow stories. Jim was born and lived in the Orkney Islands and had been in poor health for some time. We send out our most heartfelt condolences to his family and friends. Borag Thung, Earthlets, Happy New Year. Hope the start to your 2018 has been a pleasant one and the return to work or study or just general life hasn't been too hard. This week on the 2080 Thrillcast, it's something a little different. You're not going to be hearing from me. Cue cheering in the background. We've very kindly been provided with an interview by Mark Seddon with Cam Kennedy, an artist who should need no introduction to fans of the galaxy's greatest comic. Having been a commercial artist in his hometown of Glasgow, Cam worked on DC Thompson's war comic Commando between 1967 and 1972 before leaving comics altogether to become a professional fine artist. However, he was tempted back to comics in 1978, drawing Fighting Man for Battle, a title we chatted to writer Alan Hebden about in May last year. Cam then moved across to 2008 and became one of the defining artists of its first golden age, working on the VCs, Judge Dredd and Rogue Trooper. He's since worked on Zancudo with Simon Spurrier for the Judge Dredd magazine, and John Wagner wrote several stories about character Kenny Hu, who is an alter ego for Cam based on his early problems getting work at American comic book companies. For America, Cam has worked on science fiction war fantasy The Light and Darkness War for Epic, the licensed Star Wars comics for Dark Horse, Lobo Batman Outcast and the Spectre for DC, and Punisher Daredevil and Nick Fury Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. for Marvel. Now, in a connection to what we were talking about with Jim Baikie, Cam actually moved to Orkney after visiting Jim, striking up a friendship which led to Jim selling Cam some land and Cam then building his house right next door to Jim. In recent years, Cam has struggled with his eyesight, which has sadly led to a slowdown and eventual end to his professional work. He's had various operations which are still ongoing to try and improve his eyesight. I want to thank Mark for sending us this recording of his interview with Cam. Mark actually runs Cam's website, kennyhu.co.uk, as well as handling sales of his art, which all came about thanks to, coincidentally, 2080's 40th anniversary convention, something Mark writes about on the site. The interview came about as Mark went all the way up to Orkney last December to visit Cam and photograph his art to add to the website. Before we start, I do need to warn you that the quality of the recording isn't great, but either way, I need to thank Mark so much for not only recording this interview with one of my favourite and one of our favourite artists, but also offering it to the Thrillcast. So let's ease our way into 2018 with an interview with Cam Kennedy, one of the all-time greats of 2080.
In the years when I was younger, it was after the war. That's the Second World War, not the first. And, comics would start appearing in the newsagents when, it was probably about five or six. And it must have been things like the Dandy and the Beano. And then after that, it seemed to be that because rationing was stopping, that was when you couldn't get sugar and things, and it stopped. And then it seemed every time you were in the newsagent with your mum, there'd be another comic there. So then you would have to choose which ones you wanted. And I would think it would mainly be the Dandy, the Beano, and then maybe when I was about 8 or 9, it went on to things like Bees on Top, and I can't remember really. But ended up there was a whole squadron, you know, comics. And sometimes, invariably, you would go for a comic that had the free gift, i.e. a thunderclap, which was a triangle of cardboard with a bit of paper glued in between. And if you could flick your wrist really quickly with it, it made a sort of a banging noise, and that was your free gift. But so that was, I suppose, I looked at these comics kind of, you know, from the Bees of the Dandy, the Topper, and then there was, of course, the Eagle was out, mm-hmm. and I didn't bother with the Eagle much to begin with, but later on, I used to have a couple of looks at the Eagle. And after that, I don't know. I wasn't all that much into comics, but I do remember being about 12, and I lived in the south side of Glasgow, and one of the guys in my class at school or in the school, I'd got some of what they call American comics, DC comics. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, they look pretty good. Only because it was war ones. It was actually Joe Kubert's stuff. You know, right. It was Our Army at War and All American Men of War and something else. And Sergeant Rock, yeah, but that came later, but it was called Sergeant Rock. Mm-hmm. At the beginning, it was called Our Army at War, and I think All American Men of War. But I lived on the south side, and I heard that there was a gentleman's bookshop over on the north side of the river. This would have been about 4 miles from where I lived. And I set off on foot, I was about 12, and I found this gentleman's bookshop, which sold men's books with titles like Stag and Men Heroes and things. And, I mean, they weren't like nudie books, they were risque in the sense that on the cover there'd be a beautiful illustration of a barely clad woman and an American pilot, you know, and their plane was sinking in the Pacific, and that was a great drama. But these bookshops, I had heard from somebody, when they got the delivery of books in, they were buffeted and wrapped and protected with all these comics. That was what they used as packing, all these comics. And the guy in the shop recuperated a lot of these comics, which weren't too bent and torn, etc., and had them on sale. And that's where I started picking up lots of Sergeant Rock, but Our Army at War, as it was called.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I really liked the artist, Joe Kubert. Remember that? I really liked his stuff. I suppose he did influence me a bit, but that's when I was about 12 or 13. Because I remember being in the secondary school and drawing in the class for the rest of the guys and doing all these hits from machine gun bullets. Mm-hmm. They all said vip and zip and thwip. So that was the comics I liked, but I was never a huge, huge comic buff. I discovered Girls, of course, and that was when I was about 12, 13 as well, and that was very important. Always with my drawing, I just always assumed that everybody drew. So, you know, that was no big deal. But no, I wasn't all that into comics. I suppose all those American, all American men of war and our army at war, they were the ones when I left home would have been, I had a huge pile of them. And my mother gave them away to a little boy scout at the door. Have you got anything for Baba Job, missus? So she said, I gave him all those old comics he had. But that's happened to a lot of people.
Yeah. You must have at some point had the moment where you realised that maybe not everybody draws quite the same way that you do, and you sort of, you know, wanted to sort of follow it into your profession.
No, not really, no, because I left school when I was 16 and I didn't know what to do. The school actually wanted me to go to art school, they'd arranged it, but I knew better than them, you know, so I didn't want to go to art school because I probably drew better than the teachers. Mm-hmm. And as I found out later on, I did. So I got a job in a small advertising agency, Commercial Art Studio. And in those days, of course, you could get jobs very, very easily. So I was working there, and the fact that I could draw and I was producing good stuff didn't affect any thoughts I had for my future. Because, as I say, I mean, I just thought so many people would be able to draw and, you know, that would be it. But I don't know, I must have got to 17 and a half, 18, and I went off to live in London. Still not making money from my art, only in the sense that I was working for a commercial art studio. Whereby, I mean, the commercial art studio, when I first started after I left school, I was making tea. And then after that, I was doing letter set. Mm-hmm. And after that, I was doing sort of, I can't remember what you called it, just setting type on pages and doing layouts, I suppose. But it wasn't until when I was about 21. No, in fact, I got into, I was doing paintings, I was doing, you know, copies of Degas and other impressionists, that was just for my own amusement.
Right. Right.
And I had a very good friend in Glasgow, and he was a couple of years older than me, and he was, you know, to all intents and purposes, a commercial artist. But he was a great painter. I used to go to his place and used to start painting and things. And this isn't, still not doing any sorts of comic strips or anything. And then I went to London, went to France, and it was when I came back from France in 66, and I came back because I was going to get married to a French girl, and I came back to get a flat and things. And I went to see my old mate who was a painter, and he said he'd been trying to get into DC Thompson by doing comics. And I said, oh, comics, all right, okay. Because I'd never thought about comics being drawn before.
Yeah.
I really didn't. Like a lot of people, you just assumed that it turned up in the newsagents, but you had no idea of how it came about, that somebody sat down with the script and drew it out, etc., etc. So I'd come back from France, and I sent some drawings to Mr. Checkley in DC Thompson. He was the editor of Commando Comics. Mm-hmm. And he phoned me up and he sent me a script by return post and said, try this out. So that's what I did. And that's how I started with the comics. And round about the same time, I must have sent some of my drawings to, it would have been IPC Fleetway Comics at the time, who did War Picture Library or Battle Picture Library. I can't remember. And we got a script from them as well. And I think the first story of mine that actually saw print was the IPC one, and I think it was called Jungle Phantom.
Okay.
I think so, from memory. And then I was just doing lots of, you know, war stuff, you know, commando, and I don't know when battle started. Battle must have started. Was that started?
Yeah. So I think you had a break in between doing commando and then coming back for...
Yeah, because I went back to live in France in 72, and I took a couple of commando scripts with me, and then that was it. That was me finished with the comics there. And then 7 years in France, and I got into painting, back into painting. And near the end of that time, I got divorced and came back to Scotland with my two wee boys.
And the, sort of the way that I've heard you describe it before, when you came back and you got in touch with battle, sort of, it sounds so straightforward that you sort of sent them a couple of pages of some layouts of men
right.
in action. And
then, yeah, that was all. I mean, I was just looking for a bit of work, and I thought, well, I know how to draw people, so I just thought, well, try the war stuff again. And I drew out a couple of pages in that. I think I sent it to a fella called Dave Hunt, I'm not sure, or maybe it was a name like Dave Bromberg, or I just can't remember. Anyway, I got a script back in the post and started doing that. And then I was doing battle when I was still in Glasgow. That was 78, I came back doing battle. And then Steve McManus got in touch with me from 2000 AD
yep.
and asked if I would be interested in doing something. I can't remember what that was.
It would have been the VCs would have been the first thing, because that was
79. I mean, I did do a Dread away back then.
Yeah, yeah, I did.
And then they didn't ask me to do another Dread for a while. And I remember the story that John Wagner and Alan Grant say is that they wanted me on Dread, but when they asked Steve McManus, he said, oh no, Cam's too busy on Rogue.
Rogue, yeah.
He was very happy. But eventually I got, and that must have been when I did my first Dread, yeah. Because I was still doing Rogue at the time.
Looking back at that some of that early stuff, and particularly the fighting man in battle, it sort of sort of strikes you how, I guess, how different the storytelling was then, that you're having 3 pages of action in a week with so much happening on a mm-hmm. on a single page, and mm-hmm. those three pages mm-hmm. had to encompass a sort of a recap, a thrust of a story, and then a cliffhanger.
I know.
As well.
It's great. I mean, it really is a feather in the cap for, you know, like British comic book writers as well, you know. I mean, I don't know if you've ever sat down and tried to write a 3-page story, you know, with a beginning, middle and end, albeit part of an ongoing series. But as you say, you know, you always, what they told me, that as a writer, they always had to consider that somebody has just picked up this comic book, mm-hmm. this story for the first time, and had to have a good grasp on what was happening. So you had to have all that explained in the first frame. And then you've got your middle bit, and then you've got your last page, which obviously ends on a cliffhanger. You know, don't miss next week when Fighting Man goes AWOL.
And I guess you must have sort of had a reputation at that time for the sort of the attention to the detail in a lot of the technical elements of the
I started to be aware of that, you know. I mean, I was just sort of plodding along. I wasn't bothering really about comics. It was a way of making a living.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, just people started saying, you know, you've got, you know, it's pretty good trucks you do, and pretty good tanks, and pretty good this and that. And I thought, oh well, yeah, there you go. But I realised that there's a lot of artists that they're not actually quite good at that sort of thing. But I'd never say that about well, two of them, you know.
Or doing the legwork as well, I guess. Was it trips down to the library to get the reference and, you know, buying the model kits? And...
No, I went to a model shop, and like I said, doing Fighting Man, I went to a model shop and we bought a whole pile of kits, and I got mainly my oldest son, he built them up and I built some up and used to have them all around my desk when I was working, and they were away at school, and then when they came in at night he would have a look and see what I'd done, and yeah, that was the way that I did it. I mean, figure work was no problem really, I mean, I could do figures anyway, but I just wanted to get a lot of the armament and the material, the weaponry and flying vehicles, the helicopters and things. I wanted to get them right, you know.
And then when you moved into the, I guess, more fantastical elements of 2008 AD and the sci-fi, where I guess it's less of a historical representation of the way things have to
be. No, because it's purely inventive.
Yeah.
And that's what was great about Dread. I mean, if vehicles and things turned up, I mean, you could just run riot. You just make up the most amazing things. Same as when I did Light and Darkness War, because we came up with these stone ships. You know, and then I could do anything in the way of weaponry. You know, I could have a mix of a 15th century cannon and it's belt fed, you know, with dum-dum bullets. You know, completely freedom. This was good. That's what I always liked. Any work that I did, there was a lot of freedom. VCs was the same. You know, you had to stick to the uniform and things, but all your backgrounds and, you know, action scenes, you could really let yourself go.
And in fact, for VCs, a lot of the time they weren't even in uniform. It was a
no, that's true.
New
yeah.
location each episode. Yeah. It was.
I did prefer them in uniform, I have to say, because I felt you can get a lot more movement when they were in uniform and outside and whooshing about with their backpacks on and flames coming out of their arse.
It was almost more in fighting between the characters, wasn't it?
There was,
Between them and the enemy sometimes.
Yeah. But it was good. It was the enjoyable thing to do. And there was quite a few other well-known artists worked on that as well. Yeah.
Because it was Jerry Finley Day on that one, and that sort of writer artist relationship continued on into Rogue Trooper, didn't it?
Yeah. You know, I've never ever met Jerry Finley.
Have you not? So it was the script landing on your through the letterbox.
Absolutely, that's the way it was done in those days. Stagecoach pulled up at the door, and the little lad ran in. "Morning, Mr. Kennedy." And he'd give me the script. But there was something nice about getting a script through your letterbox in a brown envelope. Often the envelope was, you know, kind of torn and battered, you know, but that was just because they didn't buy high quality envelopes to send it to you.
you hear the sort of just, you know, I've not seen one of Jerry's scripts myself, but you hear him being described as a big ideas man in terms of coming up with sort of some quite interesting and out there concepts. And was it all there for you, and you just
it was all there for me, but a lot of it I mean like with any writer, I would just ignore it and do what I felt was right, and I've never had any comeback or complaint from a writer ever. I mean, that was a great thing about working with John Wagner and Alan Grant. Because they knew me and they knew we all had the same sense of humour, it was really a case of, you know, anything that John wrote and anything that Alan wrote, they knew that I would turn in a good rendition.
So it wasn't necessarily slavishly following the script, but sort of...
I wouldn't know what slavishly following the script is, because I just used to read it. And as I read it, and I would just jot down in the margin little ideas, and that was it, and then I took it from there. I never got hung up on the writer having written it, because I knew him, really, but other writers I didn't know, but I just went ahead. And nobody's ever come back and said, no, that's not the way I see it, Cam. Because it's also difficult for a writer to say to you, to criticise an artist and say, that's not really the way I see it.
Mm.
Well, you draw it then.
Yeah.
On you go. On you go, Sparky. You're that smart. It's teamwork, and it's having faith and almost like a reliability in what the artist is going to come up with. You know, if you finish one script, you know, because you've got to remember that a writer does a script. He doesn't sit at the kitchen table biting his nails until he sees what you've done with that script. Mm-hmm. He's writing other stuff.
Yep.
Albeit the next two or three episodes are the same story or something else. So, yeah, no, I mean, I think a writer would just say, that's it, it's out of my patch now, let Kennedy deal with it. That's all, yeah.
I think you said before that when you moved on to 2000 AD, that Dredd was the one that you most enjoyed doing when you got to do him.
Well, Dredd's a great character. I mean, he really is. You've only got to look at the number of artists who've worked on Dredd. Now, we all have our own rendition and version of Dredd, and he's still recognisable. Mm. The one thing I didn't enjoy too much about Dredd was, I mean, I always refused to change the uniform or anything, but except for the gun, you know, in the latter years, the gun had changed. But I used to get youngsters coming up to conventions and, you know, can you look at my portfolio? Of course I can. I've always got time to look at portfolios. But they would have done Dredd and they've changed them.
Mm.
You know, they've added on what they think Dredd should have. It's the same as I've seen other characters and they've added bits on. I say, just leave it as it is because it's working just now. Leave it. You know, you can change Batman ever so slightly, but you cannot change him, you know, like not give him a cape or a pointed cowl hat. No, just leave it the way it is. That's the way it's been created and work round it. But no, Dredd is so much fun. He's just great to do. And you become really friends with him when you join him.
Oh.
Start calling him Joe and planning holidays together and things.
But something that I've heard both, I think, Alan and John Wagner describe is how they see the partnership with you as an artist as being particularly special.
They wrote scripts for me because I know that John would put a script in and say, this is for Cam.
Yeah, they said he said he'd try and tailor it specifically for you and make sure that he'd raise it, he'd raise his game, so it's one of his favourites or one of his.
Yeah, that's it. That's what they did. Yeah, this one's for Cam, and that was an ideal way to work. Really, you know, have a writers of that caliber producing so much other stuff, and then when they do a Dredd and say, "No, this, I know this will be a good one for Cam." That's it. No, it was good. It was very.
And was that relationship still sort of the script landing with you, or was it a bit more collaborative that you'd ever feed in ideas or say, you know, this would be something I'd really love to draw?
I had carte blanche from John and Alan, as far as I understood. I mean, they were just putting a script and then what I did was fine with them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I used to add some things in, take some things out of the script, but it was always, it always worked. I mean, they always seemed to like it.
Did you ever sort of try and feed them ideas of, say, what I'd really like to draw would be this? Is there any way you could work it into a script?
There may have been. I just can't remember them just now. There may have been some of them been having a wee tete-a-tete and a wee drink.
I guess obviously there's...
In no way will I take credit for anything that they created in writing, but there may have been a couple of things.
I mean, obviously, there's the whole Kenny Who element of
them. Yeah, that was just my experiences as one of the three that was chosen to go to New York and see if we could get if they, what they were doing about the contract for Outcast that John and Alan had written. But no, that was, there's bound to have been one or two other things that we've been talking about, and then I've got it in the script. I can't. Oh, I remember. Yes, one of the things was when John and I, it was John and I, did Boba Fett and Barracuda. Mm-hmm. Barracuda was in the first story. John said, they've asked me to do another one, you know. And I'm thinking of bringing like one of his relatives. And I said, Raikuda, you know, because the rock and the singer. I think that's the way it went. I think he's called Raikuda.
Yeah, it's called
Raikuda. The brother that comes to look, well, to avenge it. Barracuda, yeah, something like that. And at the back of my mind, there's something about a haddock in some story that was mentioned, but I just can't remember for the life of me what it is. No, it's some. Anyway. But no, I mean, I'm very lucky to have worked with two great writers.
In that period where you were trying to get Outcasts sort of up and flying, and you had that infamous trip to the States,
mm.
Where, you know, the Kenny Who line came about. They, you know, they just put you forward as the most personable, they described it as, to grease the wheels.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I just thought it was very unfair. I was the one that lived the furthest away from any airport, and I had to get to the airport and fly to New York.
But it was clearly a very productive journey, because not only did you get Outcasts off the ground, you had the material for then the Kenny Who strip to follow, but then on that same trip you also met Tom Bitch.
No, that wasn't that trip, I don't think. Okay. No. Oh, I can't remember. No, I met Tom Beach because I'd been in London, and Steve Bissett, the American artist, had been over in London with his wife, and they were part of a contingent of Americans that were there, and we got on really well. Steve and I hit it off. And of course, you do the classic thing, you know, well, you know, if you're ever in Orkney, come and see me, you know, or if you're ever in Vermont, come and see me. And a while after that, I phoned him up. I said, hey, I'll come and see you. And he said, yeah, sure. So we went out to Vermont, and he said to me, he said, I got this pal who's a writer, and, you know, you and him could probably do something. So that was it. So Tom Beach go over to Steve Bissett's house, and that's where we met. That was it. So we took it from there. And Tom came up with Light and Darkness War, and yeah. I mean, there was a whole sort of discussion that day in Steve Bissett's house, and I'd been talking about this story about, you know, Second World War bomber going through a time plane and meeting other warriors on another time plane. And funnily enough, there's been a Commando comic about that, and I drew it, but I can't remember if it was before. It must have been before that. It was a bomber, just the whole thing of a bomber going through, and because I was seeing it really visual, and I had in mind a B-17, you know, sort of coming down somewhere, and you know, it turns up they used the guns. Modern technology, etc. This is kind of what we did with Light and Darkness, you know, the four Marines.
Yeah.
Well, three Marines, and the other one's lost his legs coming down and fighting for this. These good warriors, good guys. It's all good guys and bad guys, all, mostly American stuff. It's all good guys and bad guys.
It was easy to tell a bad guy in that series, wasn't it? It was.
The Lord Nah.
He was very definitely a bad guy, wasn't he?
To be played by Jack Palance in the film. But they never ever made a film. You get all this crap, you know, when you've done something and people say, oh, it's going to be made into a movie. And you think, oh, well, that's good, you know.
And it was around about that period that you sort of started doing the painterly style that you very quickly became famous for. Was it Light and Darkness that you very first started that on? Or
I just thought, well, I knew how to use colour, so I'll just use colour on this Light and Darkness. And I chose to do the first 4 or 5 pages in burnt sienna.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like to indicate flashback, I can't remember if it was it is a flashback scene, yeah. And after that then, I did Star Wars Dark Empire, and that was all done colour. It was quite a task, that, doing it in colour. But I got a lot of good feedback from people at cons, you know, who said it's so good to see something that's hand-painted. Because, mm-hmm. Digital and computer colouring was just coming in then. And they said it's so nice to see stuff that's been done by a human hand.
It struck me that from reading an interview you did before that you said that you're almost trying to future-proof your work, I guess, much like in the Kenny Who strip where you can't be taken over by a robot, that human hand, that human touch of those the colouring.
Absolutely. And it always wins out. You know, it will always win out, because there will be a certain amount of people who will realise that, oh, here's something that has not been done digitally. I mean, when my eyesight was still good, I could see jobs that had been coloured by a computer. And it's very nice, you know, it's very pristine and pristine and pure.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've got something beside it that's been hand coloured, there's little faults in it,
mm-hmm.
but nice
mm-hmm.
faults, you know, faults you can live with, faults that reassure you that there's still people working without machines. We'll probably all suffer in the end.
so the Light and the Darkness, that sort of started off that relationship with Tom, and it continued on to into the Star Wars, mm-hmm. Dark Empire,
mm-hmm.
series a few years later. How did that all come about? What was the initiation of that? It was Tom sort of reaching out to Lucas.
Yeah, well, Tom was obviously a big fan of Lucas. I was kind of unaware of him, because when the Star Wars film, the first one, came out in 77, I was living in France. Excuse me, I had no idea about it. I mean, I was really enjoying myself in France with wine, food and women and French cinema. And we finished Light and Darkness, and Tom said, "You want to do something else, buddy?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. Make a few suggestions." But I mean, I was covered for doing Dread and things. I mean, I was guaranteed work for life. You know, with Dread and Rogue Trooper was finished by then.
You had sort of a few good side projects during that time as well. You sort of you had Punisher, Blood on the Moor, which was quite a big undertaking.
Yeah, it was a big undertaking. It was 48 painted pages, but I did that, and that's no problem. Because when I wanted to, I could work really fast, etc. But he said, "What about Star Wars?" And I said, "I don't know anything about Star Wars." And he said, "You've not seen the movies?" I said, "No." I said, "I'm really sorry." "Oh, God," he said, "you got to see the movies." So at that time, it was VHS cassettes. So I went and rented. I think we rented all 3 movies. I can't remember. Might even have bought them.
Mm.
So, oh, yeah, okay. Right. So then he came back and said, "You know, got this idea of going on from the movies, and we're going to such and such." And he started talking about different, you know, planet systems that we could go to and things. And obviously he was really into it, because he was a big George Lucas fan. So I said, okay. So he said, I'll write out the first bit. So he wrote out the first bit, and he approached Archie Goodwin in Epic Comics, and Archie liked it, and then I sent some drawings to Archie, and I really liked it, and show it to Lucas. That was a goer, because, you know, I think at that time that, you know, Star Wars was going nowhere. People were sick of seeing the same photographs of Han Solo and all the other characters, and every sort of Star Wars special magazine that came out, and just the same old stuff over and over again. And that's what they do. I mean, that's the way the Americans work. They milk it, and they get a fan to buy the same magazine again, because there's two different pictures of Princess Leia.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was an interesting time for Star Wars in that the Marvel comics, as words, had stopped. They hadn't started any of the extended universe in terms of the novels. It was a good few years before the prequel films still were to come. So it was a bit of a Star Wars wasteland.
I mean, it was Marvel epic. You know, Marvel had the license at the time. And what I understand was that, I mean, Star Wars comics weren't selling. Somebody told me that they had to sell, I think it was about 5,000 or 6,000 to cover costs. And they're only selling 4,000. Mm. So when the Star Wars license ran out, Marvel didn't renew it. And that's when Dark Horse picked it up. So then I started working for Dark Horse from the second book on. First book, I think I did. And when Lucas saw the first book that I did, he said, "We want a second series."
What was this after issue one, was it?
And it wasn't out yet. He just saw the artwork.
Okay, right, more of this.
I thought, okay, that's fair enough. And Tom was really excited. And then when we were finishing the second Dark Empire, he said, "I got a third one, bro." I said, "I'm not doing it." So he was horrified, you know, that I would possibly say to George Lucas, "I'm not doing it."
Mm. Was it a case of I just found it
so boring. A lot of stuff I enjoyed doing, colouring and things, but nah, I just found it boring. And then that's when I met up with one of Lucas's assistants at San Diego, and she said, "I heard you don't want to do the third Dark Empire." And I said, "No." And then she said, "Is there anything you'd like to do?" And I said, "Yes, but you probably won't go for it." She said, "What is it?" And I said, "Well, the only person, character that interests me in the whole Star Wars thing is Boba Fett. And, you know, it might be quite good to do a book, 4 or 5 days in the life of Boba Fett, you know, because he's a bounty hunter. He goes about and he catches people. So it would give me lots of scope for characters and characters hiding in old broken down spacecraft and things on distant planets, you know." And then that's when she said, "Would you write it?" And I said, "No, John Wagner will." But John didn't know about that.
You volunteered him at the time.
Yeah, so I put his name forward. And I phoned him from Oregon, and he did it. And John did a turnaround on the whole synopsis for the first Boba Fett. About 4 or 5 days. Sounds. This is before, you know, you had emails to send stuff, you know. So it would just be by post. He would have sent it over.
So
Tom went on and got Jim Bakey, I think it was, that did the third part of Dark Empire 2. But I'd had enough, you know. But I enjoyed doing the Boba Fett because he's a wee bit in the lines of being like a Dread character. Don't screw about with him.
True. I was going to say, also in terms of that, those stories that you did for Boba Fett, there wasn't a huge amount of baggage attached to it. It was basically Boba Fett, and everything else about it was pure invention of
on my part, which is what I love. You know, I made up all these other, you know, miscreants and, you know, junkyard thieves and other characters and things. And I think the only thing, other thing from Star Wars that was in Boba Fett would have been Jabba the Hutt, I think. Because that's what I said to Lucas, called me up before I did Boba Fett. I said, I don't want to draw any of the Star Wars characters in it. But obviously John put in Jabba the Hutt because he's got a weakness for fat people. And that was it. So I did three, I think, with John. Boba Fett's, hand-coloured them all. And then I did another two Boba Fett's.
I guess the next phase of your career was that a sort of Garth Ennis sort of dominated one, that you had two chunky runs with him with the War Stories, the Reavers, and Punisher, Streets of Laredo, sort of a very similar time, both coming out in 2003.
Yeah, was that 2003? God, 14 years ago. Yeah. No, I'd met Garth when he was young, and he always used to send us a birthday card, a Christmas card. I suppose because Garth, he kind of grew up with the Battle comic when he was younger, and then he became a writer, and he must have thought, well, I've got some ideas for War Stories. And, he remembered my stuff, I think, from Battle. Mm. And got in touch. That was good. It's good to. I haven't seen him for years and years, Garth. I'd like to see him again sometime.
Don't know if he's in the States, isn't he, most of the time?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, good on him. Yeah, that's fine. In New York.
And was it sort of nice to sort of step back into that world when you were doing the War Stories after such a long break away from the Battle days?
Yeah, I mean, it's when I read the script, I thought, well, that's good, I can handle it. I can get drawing jeeps and machine guns and Chevrolet, you know, sand trucks and things. I mean, I must say, I'm very fortunate in that, I mean, I can just drift through a script, you know, if mm-hmm. there's a lot of talking heads, I can just put them down and I don't get any hang-ups about it then.
And I think you said that you don't really do with the thumbnails and the sort of the sketching
it really just goes straight down, pencil and then inked. Yeah, I mean sometimes if I can't start a page, I will persist. But then once that first pencil part of that page is down and then the rest follows, that's it. It's spontaneous.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know a few fellow professionals who do work doing thumbnails and things, but no, I just wouldn't have the time to do that. I just wouldn't see the point of doing it. You either can draw or you can't, you know, in the sense that I don't mean that to slag them off, but I'm very lucky mm-hmm. that I can just put stuff down straight away.
And
it seems to please people.
And do you ever forget the equivalent of writer's block, of drawer's block, where you just think it's not coming mm-hmm. today, after sort of step away from mm-hmm. from the board for a bit?
Yeah, I just go for a walk or do something else, yeah, absolutely. And then go back to it. The biggest flow I ever had was one day I actually got started about half past 8 in the morning. I was doing a Dread story, and by 8 o'clock at night, I'd done 3 finished pencil pages, like 21 or 22 frames. And I thought it was pretty good stuff. Mm-hmm. And as you say, yeah, other times, just nothing there. Which is what's so great about this profession, you know, you can then just go fishing or go for a walk. Or...
when you talk about your going fishing as well, sort of, I conjure up an idea of a sort of like Huckleberry Finn kind of broken stick with a you know, a bit of string and a hook on the end. What sort of thing did you do when you?
Well, I had a rod and some worms, and I would go in and go for sea trout along the road from where I live on the shore. But I haven't fished for easily 10 years. My second oldest son, he does a lot of fishing. But no, I mean, it used to be a thing. In fact, I used to wander off to fish and then just sit and watch the burn, you know, watch the river, watch the sea. Mm. That was it. And then go back and then start drawing again.
Yeah, I guess it's sort of that sort of decompression time almost. Sort of clear your mind.
I've never felt a lot of pressure with my work, you know. It's always been so easy. It's very unfair.
Really on everyone else.
I know.
But you've had some, I guess you've had some sort of very quick turnaround times in the past as well, where you sort of have either been put under pressure or put yourself under pressure to sort of try and produce, you know, something very quickly. If you know, what sort of rate have you worked at?
How much have I produced in a day?
Yeah.
Oh, see, this is one of these impossible questions to answer, but some of the Star Wars stuff, like the full page splash with the Millennium Falcon and all the space debris. Mm. I mean, because you have to work so fast because you're using watercolor on good quality watercolor paper, it can dry very quick and leave a line, a marker line where it's drying. Once I'd penciled those pages out and then I was inking them and then colouring them, and they were getting coloured in half an hour, 20 minutes.
Wow.
Because I had to work so fast. Mm-hmm. I couldn't do it now. And inking was probably about an hour. Mm. All of you bits, odds and ends. Penciling it out, probably much the same, an hour and a bit. But a lot of that colouring on Star Wars had to be done fast. Because I didn't want to leave any dry, what they call drying lines.
Mm.
I mean, you possibly could, you know, and people say that's just his style, you know, that line across the sky there, and that's where his first lot of paint dried, or his ink.
But, yeah, I mean, it feels to me, it's sort of, I get the impression that somehow miraculously you seem to have got it right first time on all of that, because I guess the colours... relatively unforgiving. If you do, you know, make a mistake, that it's gonna yeah. show, and you don't want to.
Well, you've looked at my originals for Star Wars. It's a terrible thing to say, but there's just not any mistakes on it. There's nothing. I mean, a lot of other artists' work you'll see, and there's white here and process white there, and I've corrected faults and things. But I was always very lucky. I had really good eyesight at the time, I have to say that as well. And just used to get it. It took me a long time to realise that people were impressed by what I did.
Following on from, I guess, the Reavers and that, you continued on with some 2000 AD magazine work, and then the next big project that came along was Kidnapped in 2007, with Alan.
7 or 8, or maybe Jekyll and Hyde was out in 2008.
Yeah,
and Jekyll and Hyde followed relatively close on its heels. Yeah.
And that's when my sight was starting to go, because I decided not to colour Jekyll and Hyde myself. Must have been Jamie Grant that coloured that, I think. I know he did the lettering. Anyway, what were you going to ask about?
I'd urge all of the listeners to go out and seek it out if they haven't already, because I think undoubtedly, in my eyes, one of your finest works, and certainly a very different tone to the rest of the Dread and the Star Wars, but
it's completely different, yeah. But it's a great story, you see, because when Alan was, you know, doing the breaking it down and doing a graphic novel script from Stevenson's story. I mean, I remember him saying that it really is, you know, that Kidnapped has got all the elements in it that all the other writers since then have used in their stories. You know, it's just amazing characters, isn't it? If you read the original book by Stevenson, I mean, Alan had to leave one or two things out But there's other characters come into that story and they're just great. It is real storytelling. Mm-hmm. And I was just so pleased to do it. I was just so chuffed to be asked to do that. Because I was working, it's by a Scottish writer. I was working with a Scottish writer. I'm Scottish, and it was printed in Scotland. And it's a Scottish story. It was just such a good time.
And they were also both big, big sort of local campaigns and backing behind it. The Kidnap was part of the UNESCO's City of Literature, and then mm-hmm. Jekyll and Hyde was part of the One Book, One Edinburgh mm-hmm. Campaign. And I guess that Scottish connection, you know, clearly very evident in those works, but sort of been a bit of a theme. We've, you know, seen the Kenny Who connection and Bogeyman. You had Nick Fury and immediately took him up to Orkney.
I know.
And then I think, you know, yeah, Punisher sort of take him up to Scotland as well. So does that sort of that connection to Scotland in the work, is that you know, very important to you? Is it something you particularly enjoy?
Well, yes. I mean, I do enjoy there being that connection to Scotland, but also because, I mean, a lot of the talent in modern-day British comics is Scottish. You know, and given the small population, we've got actually quite a big percentage of modern artists and writers in comics and other things who are Scottish. And that's fine because that, you know, hopefully the rest of the country will appreciate it as well, you know. But, yeah, there was just something about, as soon as they said to me, this fella phoned me up and he said, would you be able to illustrate Kidnapped? And it's something I would never, ever have thought of doing. Never in the month of Sundays. And he said, we need to get somebody to break it down. I said, well, I'll ask Alan Grant, and I phoned up Alan about a minute later, and he said, give me a wee minute to think about it, and he said, yes, I'll do it, because he loved the story from when he was younger, and that was it. So it was good, so it was very, very good, and, well, all the original artwork's with the Natural Library of Scotland now, so that's a very pleasing thing, you know, it means that my grandkids and everybody, the family, can go to Edinburgh at any time and ask to see their grandpa's artwork.
Mm-hmm. You've taken a break from, I guess, professional comic work since then. We sort of talked about
5 years.
Yeah, talked about that. You know, might still be things to.
There might be, it just depends. It depends on what happens with my eyesight. I mean, they're going to try something with it, and don't you worry, as soon as I get enough eyesight back to do a series of drawings, I'll get something done.
Even in the last few months during the summer when you were doing those few commissions out of the Dreads and the Punisher and the Midnight Surfer and whatnot, it's, you know, clear that you know you've still got the stuff. it can still get on the paper.
There's still a wee twinkle there somewhere. No, but that's, yeah.
And do you think in terms of the work that, you know, that you've done and, you know, might still do, is there a particular itch of saying, you know, there's a character or a particular idea that, you know, would really like to pursue?
No, I would actually just like to, I mean, I've got a lot of drawings in my studio and there's various characters. Which are just my characters, if you can say that. And I might just like to do something with them, albeit if it's just a 6-page story. You know, as long as I got something done. A little swan song. Imagine me having a swan song.
Can't imagine it. So I think that's a good place to wrap it up. And okay, so just Mark, to say thank you very much for your time and speaking to us, and I hope everyone that's listening enjoyed it as much as I did.
Well, I hope so. I certainly hope so. So goodbye, everybody. Goodbye.
Hope you found that as fascinating as we did, Earthlit. Absolutely great to hear from Cam. And again, thank you so much to Mark for giving us this recording. It would have been a bit of a chore to get all the way up to Orkney ourselves, so it's great to be able to hear Cam in his own words. Tune in 2 weeks' time when we're going to be celebrating our third birthday as a podcast. That's right, the Thrillcast has been going for 3 years, and we're planning one or two special little things for you. In the meantime, Splendid Verthrig.
Alert! 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 Thrill power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com. Subscribe digitally on our apps for Apple, Android, and Windows 10. And download DRM free copies from 2000adonline.com. Alert! Alert! Stand by for urgent updates. Search for 2000AD on Twitter and Facebook. Watch the latest videos at youtube.com/2000ADonline. And follow on Instagram at Insta2000AD. Program complete. Shutting down.